and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, June 16th, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel sits down with Khalil Sevright, a carpenter who has made headlines over the past 4 years as he has worked to create tiny shelters for the houseless population in Toronto. Wenzel and Sevright discuss the need to provide meaningful quality of care for the houseless and also speak about the audience response to Someone Lives Here. Someone Lives Here is a 2023 documentary that follows Sevright during the COVID-19 pandemic as he launched a project of building small private shelters for homeless people in Toronto against the bureaucratic resistance of the city government. The film premiered at the 2023 Hot Docs Festival, where it was awarded the Rogers Audience Award. Khalil Sevright is currently working with a team building tiny home communities for unhoused people in Toronto. In 2021, Rabble columnist Kathy Crowe followed Sevright's important work and his fight with the City of Toronto and then-Mayor John Tory throughout his process. You can find links to those articles in the show notes of this episode, or, for all of you listening on radio, you can find them under Kathy Crowe's column on rabble.ca. Here are Stephen Wenzel and Khalil Sevright in conversation. Take a listen.
Khalil, the film isn't out yet on streaming, or it's not widely available, but the impact, the response to the film has been pretty incredible. What's your response to what people are thinking about the film?
My hope is that it's just inspiring a lot of conversations about what to do next, because the movie sort of ends on a eerie note where everything's back to normal and it's as if nothing had ever happened. And it's like the invisibilizing of homelessness. And I feel like that will make people feel more uncomfortable with, you know, going about their daily lives, trying to not acknowledging that this is happening and not acknowledging that this is something that continues to get worse. So I think it's, I don't know, just excited about the conversations that it's inspiring and hopefully the policy changes that will follow that.
Absolutely. And so what are some of the lessons that you hope people take away when they watch the film?
Yeah, I mean, there's something about the way the city of Toronto specifically operates that is very disorganized, just the disorganization between departments. And I guess even after the film was made, you can see with the creation of the shelter hotel program and just how much it cost the city. And now they're having to shut them down and people are going back to being unhoused. There isn't a clear coordination within the city for dealing with homelessness. And so you have these decisions being made sort of haphazardly that are costing lots and lots of money that aren't fundamentally solving any problem. So I feel like that is a key thing I hope people can pick up on through the film and just, I don't know.
Let me take you back. Let's go back to, not that any of us really want to, let's go back to the early days of the COVID lockdown and the pandemic in 2020. Tell me about the moment you realized that you needed to help in this way by building these tiny shelters.
It was sort of something that was always in the back of my mind since coming back to Toronto from BC. And yeah, just the moment I saw so many encampments, it was like in my mind then, but it didn't really seem like something I would do. It was just there. And then as the summer went on and the encampments grew, I sort of figured, oh yeah, people will probably just find a spot inside. They'll probably go somewhere. They won't stay outside during the winter in Toronto because that's terrible. And they just continued to be there. So I figured, okay, like this is actually something I can do without imagining that it would be a large scale thing. And yeah, so that's sort of when that became a reality to me.
And so, you know, we see you kind of around that time, you switch gears and really kind of take this on as a full-time project. building these shelters for folks who are unhoused, particularly with urgency in mind as the seasons start to change. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, there was this moment early in the documentary where there's a gentleman speaking about, you know, they have shelters, but, you know, not everybody's going to go. And there's this conversation happening where someone is thinking there must be all these resources that they're just not being taken up on. But, you know, you're pointing out, well, these come with conditions, the hotels, it's not like a free for all. And can you talk a little bit about how that misconception about shelters, shelter programs and hotels, can you talk a bit how people who are housed really kind of have it all wrong?
Yeah, and I just feel like it that comes down to just not knowing what's required to be in the shelter system and not knowing the things that you can do to get kicked out of that situation, which end up being very minor, and that happens very frequently. So there's restrictions on how many things you can carry with you. Usually it's a 2-bag limit. So if you own anything beyond that, you can't bring it inside, or if you bring it inside, it gets removed. And there's sort of checks that happen while you're sleeping at a lot of respite sites and in shelters where it's a mandatory checkup to make sure that you're still alive, but it's very invasive. And it's just unlocking your door while you're sleeping and looking at you, making sure you're breathing, and then leaving. And that's a troubling thing for a lot of people. And something that is really prevalent as well is just getting into arguments with staff about any which thing, and then that being a justification for you not being able to sleep comfortably, not getting a place to, not getting a bed to sleep on. And that's actually very common as well. And then there's also a thing with many shelters and respites where you are kicked out during the day. So you have to leave in the morning, and then you have to be out all day, and then you have to come back by a certain time. And if you don't make it back by that time, you lose your spot. So it's like, there's a very, I don't know, it just doesn't make sense for the reality of many folks. For you to be in the system and maintain consistent housing, it just doesn't work out for a lot of people for those reasons. And just the reality of like just trying to get into those spaces without already having access into them, just having to call in, and you don't have a cell phone. You're using a payphone every hour to call and call and call. And I feel like this is a reality that more people, I imagine, are aware of now, but probably weren't maybe a few years ago, is that our shelter system is generally at capacity. It's generally at 98% capacity. So it's like the reason that a lot of folks are staying outside is literally because they have tried to get inside and they can't. So there's a limitation to the capacity in Toronto to house people that are sleeping outside, and that continues to be a problem.
Yeah, and one of your clients that you spoke with during the film, she said that you know, being in the shelter is worse than being in jail, because you could never have a good night's sleep. You know, there was no sense of privacy, there was no sense of safety, of quality of care, and I think that really spoke to me. And then I want to kind of shift gears as well to talk about when Zach first approached you to take your project kind of to the next level and document it for a film. Did you know Zach before, and how did the two of you kind of agree on going forward on this project?
I did not know Zach at all beforehand. And I guess he, with many other people, reached out to me to do a documentary once the story came out with CBC, and then we raised a bunch of funding, and then we were just building. And I guess I said no to everyone, including him. And he was just extremely persistent, and he just kept asking. And I sort of said, you know what, if you film a how-to video for me, I'll consider letting you do a documentary. And then he showed up, and then he filmed the how-to video, and it ended up being like an hour long. And he did a lot of work editing it down to that hour, and just did it really quickly. And I guess it was a nice, or I didn't mind working with him at that point, but there was definitely like a long period of not trusting him at all and not knowing how him filming me would turn out. And just as we continued to work together, it just became more and more apparent that Zach's an awesome person. And yeah, and then it also shows in the way that he created the documentary.
Yeah, and where I'm located in Halifax, we kind of saw a similar campaign that followed yours, a group called Halifax Mutual Aid. We're building tiny shelters around our city, and we saw those destroyed by the city. But I think one thing that people didn't really seem to understand was, you know, a lot of folks who are experiencing homelessness, like, if I suddenly became unhoused, I have a pet that is like my child, and I wouldn't just be able to take my pet into the shelter with me and go about my life. And so, like, can you talk about how your tiny shelters, not even just in, you know, having a space for pets, but, you know, having a lock on your door, having a place to keep your belongings securely. Can you talk about how these things are significant and do contribute to quality of life, even in this tiny structure?
Yeah. And I can say, like, anecdotally that, you know, just being able to have a pet with you, that is enough to really maintain, I don't know, a healthy state of mind. But I guess a part of the work that I'm doing now, it's I guess I'm working with the team and we're building a tiny home community in Toronto. And a part of that work is just having to, like, do interviews and actually write down the results of these interviews with folks that are staying outside. And some of this information for, you know, what are some major things that you think would help you become ready to stay, get into transitional housing or get into permanent housing and stay in there. And one of those things is just having a pet. Yeah. Because it's like, this is someone that you are accountable for, that you have to be consistent for. And it's like, you know, if you're making a promise to yourself to be this or do that, now you have a pet with you to help you do that. That you, all right, I'm going to go on walks whenever I feel like drinking. Great. Now I get to do this thing every day with my dog, instead of trying to do this on my own. And yeah, it plays a major role.
In addition to the pets, kind of having that place to secure your belongings, having a lock on your door, can you talk about how those things really make, like, a concrete difference in kind of those first steps on getting your life back?
Yeah, and I think, yeah, it just provides consistency. You know you're going to leave and come back and things aren't going to be, your life isn't going to be completely turned upside down, and you're not going to have all of your things stolen. Your medication is still going to be there. Your IDs are still going to be where you put them. You don't have to, you know, fight to get those things again just to get, you know, just to be able to do your taxes or something else that requires it. So it created a really fundamental consistency that you don't generally have when you're staying in a tent. And then on top of that, just the physical being off of the ground and being dry and just having a roof over your head that will never leak, that's huge. And then on top of that, with how insulated they were, it was also a space that was extremely quiet. So a lot of people commented on finally being able to have a really solid sleep and not being worried about someone opening the door or, like, coming in on them or doing something to them. It's like they have a state of mind, or they have a peace of mind where they can just lay down and have a solid sleep. And that I think that is actually one of the largest factors in just having a stable life, is just being able to sleep. Because a lot of folks that are staying outside, it's like they're just not able to sleep a lot of the time, and that really destroys their state of mind.
Now, one thing that I really kind of wanted to cover when I chatted with you, Khalil, is kind of this, the difficulty of picking up the slack of our elected officials and the unintended consequences of doing so. And I guess what I mean by that is, you know, you started this tiny shelters project as a response to this failure by the city of Toronto to address homelessness. And it was very interesting to watch throughout the documentary. You know, at first the city congratulated you and said they wanted to work together, describing it as a partnership. But very quickly, you know, we learned that that wasn't the case, and it became more combative, I guess, on their part. So you went from building these shelters and helping folks stay alive in the cold of winter to now being threatened to be fined by the city for trying to help, for trying to do the work that the elected officials just simply weren't doing. And I'm wondering, can you talk a bit about when you find yourself in a spot like this, what does that feel like?
Stressful. And I guess the only one of the main things for me that mitigated the stress while we were building was just knowing that I was on the side of gravity. That, I don't know, from speaking to some counselors before jumping into certain meetings to make the case for the tiny shelters, it was apparent that, you know, encampments are a huge problem to them. But then when you start to speak about the details of, you know, like if someone's staying in a tent and they're using a propane heater to stay warm because there's no insulation on the tent, it's like the city isn't liable for that. So that's, there's not a pressing safety issue to make sure that these people aren't doing that, because they will not be held responsible for that. But if they sanction the tiny shelters, then they will be held responsible for that. So that was an interesting understanding of like their perspective legally. I don't know. It was a difficult position to be in, and it felt like what was limiting them from really helping people in a very real way were abstract ideas about who is responsible, about who gets the blame when something happens. And yeah, it was a weird space. It was constantly frustrating, and it became more and more and more frustrating as time went on. And I guess I did come to the conclusion, though, that if you're not working with the government, and I guess I say government, I say another way to put that is if you're not working with the organization that has the monopoly of violence in your region, that you will most likely be crushed by them if they don't agree with you. And that is sort of what happened. And I guess with what I'm working on now, we are definitely making a very strong effort to work with the city, even though what we believe, what we're doing, we believe is something that should exist regardless of city approval. We want to have that to make sure it doesn't get destroyed.
Kind of looking back on, you know, looking ahead to the hot dogs screening, what is it like to go to a film screening and see yourself on screen and hear the reactions firsthand from people watching?
It was very surreal. It felt like a dream for sure. And yeah, because I've seen the like Zach sent me a version of the documentary beforehand and I watched it and I was like, yeah, it's good. Cool. And then I guess showing up and watching it and seeing my face, it's like such a surreal thing to see your face so large and then all these other people are watching it with you and laughing and screaming, and it was surreal. And I guess I cried, and I was surprised by how I cried when I actually watched it in the theater. And yeah, I didn't realize I'd be so shaken by that. Yeah, that experience. Yeah.
It's a really powerful documentary. And I think that obviously, you know, Zach is responsible for part of that, but I think that you allowing him to follow your journey so intimately and you know, to build that trust and build that relationship, that really helped make the documentary, you know, what it is. One last thing I want to touch on. There was a familiar face to Ravel that appeared in the documentary, Kathy Crow. She's a street nurse. And she had a very, and her and I have had this conversation before, but she had this clip on CBC where she said, you know, before the pandemic, I was opposed to the idea of this tiny shelters thing, completely against it. And she said, but over the last month, I've completely changed my mind. And it's, you know, that's someone who's worked in this field for decades. And just how quickly, you know, we can change minds when we think about how to do things differently, when we, you know, kind of think outside the box. Can you talk a bit about how the public perception around your work has changed between since the time you started and now that this documentary is coming out?
I guess or at least when I started, I felt like overwhelmingly the public was on my side, and it was mainly council and like I guess it's hard to say. There were definitely a section of the public that disliked the encampments and also disliked my efforts. And like you go on Reddit and you see these comments sort of saying, oh yeah, like is this going to decrease the property of my home? And it's like just interesting concerns, like when you see people like fighting to stay alive across the street, and that's a concern. But I think now with the documentary coming out, many of those people that would have disagreed with the encampment, and like seeing that there still are encampments, seeing that there's still people outside, it's like, I feel like more people are seeing the, or there is more of a positive response to that project, especially now that it's not currently happening. I feel like a lot of people are finding it much easier to see the benefit of that project being, yeah, having existed. And yeah, I think there is more support now than there was, but I also felt like there was a lot of support when it was happening. So
great. Well, that does it for all of my questions. You covered a lot of ground in a short period of time. Khalil, was there anything that you want people to know?
I guess I wanted to talk about things that I'm working on now.
Yeah, please do.
Cool. Well, yeah, so I guess I brought up the tiny home community. I should say cabin community. That is what we say on paper every time. So we've been meeting for maybe a year and a half almost now every week to talk about this project. And I'm on a team with architect John Van Nostrand of SVN Architects and Planners and Sheila Penny from Toronto Community Housing, who was the COO of Toronto Community Housing for about 30 years. And yeah, they're a great team. And along with them, there's a few engineers and some folks that help volunteer to build tiny shelters when I was working on them. And we've been meeting with counselors and we've been talking about this project with different organizations. And it really does look like we're going to be able to do this project. The timeline's unclear, but I feel very confident about it. And yeah, I guess the idea is based off of a community in Kitchener called the Better Tent City that's been operating for 3 years. They have 42 cabins housing 50 people, and they have a central washroom and shower and laundry building, and then a central building that's more of a community center with a kitchen. And yeah, it seems to really work for folks that have a hard time fitting into the shelter system, that want to have more autonomy, that want to have more community, and also just want to have their own key to their own door and a consistent space that's theirs. So it seems to really be satisfying like key needs that people have that they're not having satisfied currently. And yeah, just very excited about that project.
National politics reporter Stephen Wenzel and Khalil Sevright in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Stephen and Khalil. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Here to bring us up to date on the news of the week on Rabble.ca, here is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in labor news, Rabble Labor reporter Gabriela Kaluge-Kasuga covered a new study from the Community-Based Research Center, which showed that workplace discrimination has an adverse health effect on those being oppressed. Gay and bisexual men who have sex with men continue to face violence and discrimination, including in workplace settings, said Dr. Olivier Frelat from the Université de Montréal. Those who identified as queer, Indigenous, Latino, or low income experienced higher rates of discrimination than those who identified as gay or bisexual, white, or earned an annual income of more than $60,000. The study encouraged workplaces to be proactive and explicit in their efforts to be more inclusive of minority groups. In national politics, federal by-elections will be held in 4 ridings on Monday to fill vacancies in the House of Commons. Federal Green Party co-leader Jonathan Petno is running in the riding of NDG Westmount in Montreal. National politics reporter Stephen Wenzel interviewed Petno, who said that as a gay man of color, he was eager to represent the diverse riding. Petno says his background as a human rights abuse investigator taught him an important lesson about politics, saying, quote, "You can pass as many laws or conventions as you want, but if states won't actually implement them, then they are not as good as the paper they are written on," end quote. Petno became the first openly gay leader of a federal party in 2022 when he was elected leader of the Green Party on a joint ticket with former leader Elizabeth May. In economic news, Canadian economist Jim Stanford explained in an op-ed on Rabble how the Bank of Canada's continual raising of interest rates is self-defeating. Not only is this punishing Canadians who can least afford the extra financial pressure, it is also exacerbating the housing crisis. High interest rates, Stanford argues, is forcing some Canadians into the rental market, reducing incentives to build more homes, while at the same time causing landlords to raise rent prices in an effort to pay off the increased interest on their own mortgages. Investment in the residential market has fallen every financial quarter since the Bank of Canada began raising interest rates last spring, and is down a full 20% since last year. In other economic news, celebrated Canadian economist Kerry Polanyi-Levitt turned 100 this week. Levitt's work focuses on analyzing the relationship between politics and the economy. An Order of Canada recipient, her citation credits her with establishing international development as an interdisciplinary academic field of study. Throughout her career, she was a builder, a co-founder of the Canadian Association for the Study of International Development, contributor to the Association of Caribbean Economists, and with Professor Marguerite Mendel, established the Carl Polanyi Institute at Concordia University, dedicated to her father. And finally, on Wednesday, June 21st at 4:30 p.m. Pacific, 7:30 p.m. Eastern, join us for our final Off the Hill political panel before our summer hiatus. This month, we focus on National Indigenous Peoples Day. What is causing the slow-moving action on the 94 calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada? What can land back look like across Turtle Island? And are we any closer to true reconciliation? Join our guests this month as we tackle these questions and more. Register today with the link in our show notes, or for all of you listening on the radio, visit rabble.ca. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to share Rabble Radio on your campus, college, or community radio station? It's easy. To find out more information on how your local radio station can become a host for Rabble Radio, please email us at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.